coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
You know, it's not an absolute requirement, but it does help to have a veteran on staff or somebody that's worked with a lot of veterans, because it's almost like any professional organization, but even more tight-knit, is that veterans really trust other veterans. And it can be hard to breach that gap. A lot of therapists in general have a very hard time with PTSD patients because the veteran just doesn't trust them. And that relationship can take years. But sometimes that's not necessary. And so then it's all about like listening, getting to know where they're at, and you can overcome that. The big part is, you know, I think it's, as with anything, it's there's not one veteran. And yes, they're going through these extreme environments, but everybody within those environments interpret it a little bit differently, process the trauma differently. And so it's kind of understanding, you know, how they view the trauma, how they view their relationship to the trauma and their situation there. You know, maybe ayahuasca itself might be a little bit too harsh for them. So maybe something like lighter dose of psilocybin or something where they can kind of get the grasp of it. You know, it's hard to say on the specific side, but you kind of have to know of how they are relating to their trauma. And a lot of that has to do with their background as well.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts, presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. MDMA therapy for veterans suffering from PTSD has gotten a lot of attention in the world of psychedelic medicine lately. Meanwhile, Jesse Gold is bringing veterans to South and Central American retreats for ayahuasca healing with his nonprofit, the Heroic Hearts Project. On the show, Jesse explains how psychedelic therapists and healers should think about working with veterans. He describes his own experience with PTSD and ayahuasca, as well as the details of the Heroic Hearts program, from funding to integration coaching. Jesse gracefully responds to the delicate question of how U.S. foreign policy plays into healing veterans in Latin American countries. Jesse Gold is a former Army Ranger who founded the Heroic Hearts Project in 2017 to connect military veterans struggling with mental trauma to ayahuasca retreats and other psychedelic medicine resources. Heroic Hearts is a registered 501c3 nonprofit that has raised over $350,000, all of which goes directly to supporting veterans. Jesse speaks globally on psychedelics and mental health, and his work has appeared in the New York Times as well as numerous podcasts and conferences. Ayahuasca is a powerful medicine that is changing veterans' lives. So if you want to support the troops, support psychedelic medicine. Here we are. Well, thank you for your patience as we've had a little bit of a stumble into our container today, which sometimes can happen in the psychedelic space as well. But I think it's like in the psychedelic space, you take a deep breath, sit up straight, and begin again. Jesse, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'm really inspired by the work that you're doing and really excited for the opportunity that we have to talk about it. And for our listeners, many of whom are healers and therapists themselves, I think that the wisdom that you've garnered with all of the people that you've helped is going to be really informative for those listening. So I really appreciate what you're doing with the nonprofit and also just coming on the show and sharing your wisdom today.
Well, I always appreciate these conversations, and I appreciate you having me. You know, I think the more of us talking about this and sharing information, the better. Most of us have the same sort of goal at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think in the realm of healing, we're all looking for open-hearted connectedness, joy. And there's a lot of collaboration, I feel, in this space, particularly in the space of psychedelics. There's a lot of wanting to share best practices. And with a medicine like ayahuasca, for example, you know, there are some contraindications. There's things that you need to know before going in. You need to know the right retreat centers to go to. So, you know, you being willing and able to share some of what you've learned in your experience with Heroic Hearts is extremely valuable. How long have you been doing Heroic Hearts?
About 3.5 years now. So it's still relatively new, but it definitely has been, you know, everything on acceleration, not only just the way that the response to the organization, but the psychedelic world in general, I'm sure most people are aware of just sort of the nitro fuel within the progression and the discussion and science around it. So it's been a very jam-packed 3.5 years. And, you know, fortunately, I was able to be flexible and nimble enough to survive it.
When did you first hear about ayahuasca?
It's hard to say pinpoint. You know, I think it was around the same time that I was having my own struggles. I got out of the military in 2014 and tried to, you know, readapt to civilian life as much as possible, but started having a lot of issues. But counter to that, it was already starting to come into the media, whether you might have seen it on a Netflix show or heard it in a podcast. At the time, with my buddy listening to Joe Rogan Experience, and so it's always brought up there. And so I heard about it, but I always kind of lumped it into sort of this psychedelic realm or just sort of this drug realm. You know, I prior to my first experience, had no experience with psychedelics or what some people consider drugs in general. Just wasn't for me. I had no issue with other people doing it, but I just didn't see the purpose, and the people that sung its praises, I kind of viewed them skeptically. And so even when I heard it, I kind of understood what it was, but it wasn't like, oh, let's go do that tomorrow.
And I imagine that's something that's quite common in veteran communities where folks are not necessarily, it's not necessarily the best cultural fit for many service people. And for example, like Burning Man or like these kind of more sort of hippie vibes, there's a bit of a cultural disconnect that I think might make it more difficult for some folks to be able to access these medicines.
It's definitely on the superficial level, two very separate communities, like separate parts of the Venn diagram. But what we're finding is that the Venn diagram actually does have a pretty big intersection point. And so it's about changing people's, you know, everybody has a personal narrative of who they were. And I had that same sort of thing. And I think not only military, but generationally, coming from that DARE generation perspective, you have this immediate inclination that illegal drugs make you a bad person or that they make you commit crimes. And yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I think more often than not, the military community tends to be more conservative in a lot of ways. And you're also just within the military, it's a very regimented, you know, you can't do drugs in there, you'll get kicked out, and just very purpose oriented.
So you grew up in the DARE era, as did I. What year were you born?
87.
I'm 82. I remember the Just Say No. I remember the ad where you're supposed to not smoke weed. And so if someone says that you're a chicken for not smoking weed, the little kid is like, I'm not a chicken, you're a turkey. And that was the ad. And I remember like at the time, like thinking that that was all pretty cheesy, but it was still very much in my system to think that like drugs are bad. And to your point that drugs are used by people whose lives are failing, you know?
Right.
And I think that when you look at something like, you know, PTSD, someone who's suffering from acute PTSD, their life isn't going very well. You know, it's very difficult to maintain appointments. It's very difficult. You know, a lot of people have different challenges. And then if you look at people who have substance abuse disorders that are related to some of these mental health illnesses, the whole realm of psychedelics can be kind of lumped in as like, oh, that's just going to make a bad situation worse.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of how like stereotypes work. You see, you know, pot gets a bad reputation from, you know, the stoner you knew in high school who wasn't doing anything or, you know, what have you. I mean, my first DARE generation, the one I remember also was fifth grade. They had the officer come in. He was this big, muscular, like tattooed up guy, and everybody was sort of afraid of him. And he was just telling us about, you know, all the things he's seen, sort of that scare tactic. And he stopped coming after a couple of weeks. And after a while, we found out that he had actually relapsed himself, which was just a perfect, I mean, unfortunately for him, but sort of the perfect irony of the whole situation of, you know, it's not necessarily about just saying no, especially if you have a problem, you know. And I think that's just abstaining from drugs is not going to solve the world's problems.
Yeah, there's addiction is so often, and yes, of course, there are neurological underpinnings of it, but it's so often related to trauma and related to wounds and related to trying to compensate for some major disquiet in your system. And for me personally, in my own use in psychedelics and what I've seen in psychedelic medicine, psychedelics are actually incredible modalities for being able to discover these stuck parts or these exiled parts or the things that you don't want to look at, and actually allowing you to kind of reintegrate these aspects of yourself or re-experience something in a way that feels safer. And so it's such a painful irony that on one hand you have these substance abuse disorders, but then on the other hand, psychedelics actually can be healing for that, and yet they're all kind of lumped up into one thing. And that's hard programming to change with people.
Yeah, and you have something like ketamine that kind of has a little bit of both worlds, which is interesting. And yeah, I mean, like, to that point, it's something I've always sort of had the inclination on, but just have found it more and more, is that whether or not this is the VA's fault or across the board in terms of how we deal with a lot of these traumas, is that they tend to be much more complex than the labels allow. And so you almost view addiction, like chemical addiction, as one thing without necessarily understanding where that addiction is coming from. We sort of view PTSD as this one thing without understanding there's a lot of different factors, even physical ones, traumatic brain injury, for instance, that are playing into it, which don't necessarily get the attention, don't get evaluated. And so what I found with addiction too, and one of the things in our assessment process, which is hard given that there's not that much known about it, is where is the addiction coming from? And sometimes this can be impossible to ascertain. But, you know, there are some people that seem more inclined to be alcoholics or addicts, whether or not that's a chemical hooks. I know that can be kind of dubious in some research, but there do seem to be people that are more inclined to have that addictive personality or go into that. But then there's other people who fall into drugs and fall into alcohol because of trauma, because they're just trying to not feel that pain or chronic pain, for instance, or they're just trying to ignore it. And so you have this substance abuse, which on the outside can appear and can also turn into addiction, but may have different root causes. You know, not everybody that becomes an addict necessarily had a horrible childhood or bad childhood, and not necessarily everybody, you know, both sides of that.
It seems like you must have had a total crash course in these topics over the past 3.5 years. Did you, prior to your work with Heroic Hearts, had you studied psychology? Had you worked in social work in any way? Or were you mainly coming to this as a veteran who'd done your own healing and then wanting to give that to the people around you?
In terms of psychology, nothing more than a very, you know, basic, you know, outside user sort of experience, you know, maybe a couple of classes in college, some very interesting going the whole dynamics, including some neurophysiology, and, you know, reading sort of the pop culture books, which can be good, but can be bad as well. I really feel like the most I learned was just through my own internal exploration, because even pre-military and during the military, of just being able to see what I have gone through and seeing changes as a result of my environment, as a result of the people around me, and thinking and contemplating why these changes are happening and the things I still have. So even as a kid, I had anxiety, or I had a lot of social anxiety. It was very hard for me to, you know, ask somebody out on a date. And understanding why this was so hard for me, it was always just, you know, like in high school, you're like, why can't I do this when my buddies are doing it over there? And so I really turned inward to try to figure it out. And just through my own journey, there's been a lot of dramatic shifts, really informed me on a level. And not saying I'm an expert, but oftentimes I've gone like, well, this has worked for me and this is how I see it. And maybe this can give you some answers. And I've found, especially with what we're doing, most people have their own unique interpretation on some level of what's going on around them and what they need to do. You know, some people might be more spiritual or religious. Some people really latch on to the analytic. Like if you explain the science to them, then that's what they need. And some people just need sort of that, the easy way to understand it. And so it's not on me to tell them how to understand it, but it's on me to offer a suggestion and maybe they might bond to that, and then that can help them on their own process.
Yeah, so I imagine you have a pretty holistic perspective on psychedelic healing, and probably based on what you've just said, developed a lot of literacy in how to discuss these compounds with people who might be suffering and could benefit a lot from them.
Yeah, I tried to. You know, it's sort of my job unofficially is try to provide as much as possible. And, you know, I have the help of my team. So I have some very intelligent and dedicated people that come from different arrays. So, you know, one guy, he's even more military than I am. He was in 20 years, 15 deployments, and looks the part. And so he can speak to different guys than I might be able to. And then we have Kate, who's a PhD in neurophysiology. And so she can really dive into the specific mechanisms. And so I think my job as sort of the head of it is to have enough of a knowledge and literacy in what's going on. And one, to make sure that we're doing it right and we're not doing a disservice and we're not overstepping, but two, be able to talk, because like I said, that's how we are trying to present this message. If you want to know the science, you know, we're working with some universities. We can show you what this is saying. If you want to know sort of the indigenous side of things of how they view and what they think is going on, you know, we can present that and connect you to people. And then just different arrays of where somebody's coming at, and hopefully they latch on to something.
Many of the people listening to this podcast are themselves psychedelic therapists or healers. And I'm guessing that many of them don't have a lot of their own experience in understanding what it might be like to be deployed in a combat zone. And I'd love for you to share a bit about what your experience was like in your time in Afghanistan, and just kind of give us, as psychedelic healers who want to be able to support veterans, can you give us some of an idea of what it is like? I mean, obviously, this is a huge question and we are on an hour-long podcast, so you're not going to be able to share the depth of that experience, but maybe I'll ask it this way. What do you think is the most important thing that you would want someone who is holding a psychedelic healing space, whether it's a retreat, ketamine therapy, what would you like them to know most when they're going to be working with veterans, perhaps based on your own experience?
I mean, one, it really does help to, you know, it's not an absolute requirement, but it does help to have a veteran on staff or somebody that can relate to that, that's worked with a lot of veterans, because it's almost like any professional organization, but even more tight-knit, is that veterans really trust other veterans. And it can be hard to breach that gap. A lot of therapists in general have a very hard time with PTSD patients because the veteran just doesn't trust them. And that relationship can take years. But sometimes that's not necessary. And so then it's all about like listening, getting to know where they're at, and you can overcome that. The big part is, you know, I think it's, as with anything, it's there's not one veteran. And yes, they're going through these extreme environments, but everybody within those environments interpret it a little bit differently, process the trauma differently. And so it's kind of understanding, you know, how they view the trauma, how they view their relationship to the trauma and their situation there. So sort of an example that might bring more light to this is I found a lot of success with special operations veterans when we go through our program. Because we do our own vetting through what we found to see, if, obviously, the safety side of it, but see if they're going to be good candidates and that they're at that right level of healing. And special operations across the board, so you have like Navy SEALs, Rangers, Special Forces, which are the Green Berets, Marine Recon, they all have to go through the selection process. And the vast majority of the selection process is, you know, less than 10% will make it through. And the reason why I think that they take to this sort of therapy is that the way they view obstacles, the way they view challenges, the whole point of selection is like, I'm going to take every comfort, I'm going to throw every stress at you in a short period of time. Are you going to quit? Are you going to continue on? Are you going to find ways around the obstacles? And so a lot of those, when they have, they still are, they're subject to PTSD, but it tends to be different than somebody that might not be selected for that. So a lot of special operations, for the average person, if they see something horrific or something terrible goes on, they might not necessarily have as much of a psychological issue. They might not have that persona break inside of them as somebody else does. And so understanding that, I think, is key of how you're going to approach them through that. Because, for instance, guys that I know are in that group, like especially something that can be as hard as ayahuasca, it's more of presenting of like, hey, this is another obstacle. It's going to be super hard, but there is a way for you to get around it. It's just all about going in there with that warrior spirit, you know, going there until you complete the mission and give it your all. Like it's a lot of the guys had some of the worst days of their lives, and that says a lot, but they understood what that meant. Whereas somebody else who might have been more traumatized by their experience, then it's going to be a little bit different approach. You might have to be, you know, maybe ayahuasca itself might be a little bit too harsh for them. So maybe something like lighter dose of psilocybin or something where they can kind of get the grasp of it. You know, it's hard to say on the specific side, but you kind of have to know of how they are relating to their trauma. And a lot of that has to do with their background as well.
It's really interesting what you're talking about with working with special forces. I interviewed Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote a book called The Body Keeps the Score, and he's one of the foremost trauma researchers. And he talks about, you know, developmental trauma then informing acute trauma later. So I would imagine that for some of the people who are in special forces, that they might have already been screened for some of these earlier traumas or earlier psychological challenges. And then they're actually working with trauma that actually occurred while they were in a combat zone, rather than someone who's coming to the table with maybe some childhood trauma and then it's sort of compounding onto that. So it was interesting when you were saying that might be part of why this group of veterans tend to do better in this environment.
And a lot of them still might have some pretty severe childhood trauma. You know, I knew a lot of guys. It's just a question of how they've been able to deal with it or compartmentalize it or still be able to function at a very high level despite it. And so it could still take, when you break down those walls, you know, there could still be some pretty deep stuff, some pretty dark stuff that you have to deal with. But, and again, how hard it is going to be break down those walls factors a lot into that of like, are they just very good at compartmentalizing and moving forward despite everything that's going on? So it's one of those things that fortunately I think psychedelics will bring a lot of light to that. I don't necessarily think that is as considered as it should in some of the current options.
When you yourself first approached ayahuasca, were you approaching it to meet a specific challenge? Were you diagnosed with, for example, PTSD coming out of your time in Afghanistan? Were you looking for something specific in terms of healing? What brought you to drink ayahuasca?
So I was diagnosed, but that had a very little factor just because I saw how I was diagnosed. And so it was more of, it took them a while. And so the way the military works is when you get out, you don't have to, but if you have injuries from your service, whether it's mental or physical, even if you get a 0% disability rating, that means that they understand that maybe your knee is going to go out in 10 years time because of, you know, you're doing airborne jumps. And so it behooves a lot of people to do that. And so during that, I was diagnosed with it, but it was, you know, literally a 15-minute check the box of like, are you angry? Do you get angry? Have you had trouble sleeping? Without any, you know, there's no way you can assess that in 15 minutes. So even though I got that, it wasn't defining me and I knew it was kind of bullshit, but I knew there was something wrong with me, but I just knew that maybe that was it, or maybe it was something else. So when I was going back into civilian life, I was working in corporate finance. And, you know, that's as much as I try to ignore it, a lot of these issues started coming up.
What issues were coming up?
So like, it just, like I said before, another podcast, like it was like a dark cloud. It's just like this dark presence, this force like holding me back. You know, when you know you're not operating at 100%, you know you're not operating at especially coming from this ranger, like elite sort of mind frame. But then just, you know, like I said, I had anxiety before, but this definitely shifted it and transformed it into a much more sort of vicious force. And it would go into these deep depressions. And I just found myself self-medicating with alcohol a lot and just, you know, showing up to work super hungover, having to, you know, take that morning beer just to be able to function. But again, I was still very able to function and I was still able to do my job well. But it was on the inside. You know, on the outside, people might have not been able to see it, maybe some, but on the inside, I just knew I was like tearing myself up. I was, you know, having more risky behavior, just less concerned about my life, and just more unhappy. And it was just, there's no way I could get out of this unhappy vessel. And so I try to improve my life. I eat healthy, new hobbies, be social. And on the surface, all the check marks, I had everything that you should be happy with. You know, I had the good job, I had friends, I had a great place to live, but even trying to go to the VA, but nothing would get me past that. And so that's where sort of the intuition warning lights started flaring. And that's when I didn't know what, and I knew that the options that I had explored were not sufficient. And I knew from what I had researched with SSRIs and other antidepressants that the answers weren't there either. And so it sort of led me on a journey to like figure out what was going on with me and how can I get over it. And it was a slow process, but you know, whatever my intuition drove me or forces aligned. And that was around the same time I heard about ayahuasca, and it just became this glaring truth of I need to do something. This seems interesting. I've heard a lot of great stories around it. I was still very skeptical, but let's give this a shot. You know, I've tried these other options. Why not?
Now, I've heard you speak about being very careful that something like ayahuasca or another psychedelic is not a silver bullet. It facilitates healing, but there's a lot of work that goes into it too. With that in mind, I'm curious, however, when you did drink ayahuasca, if there was an aha moment, like a light turned on, or maybe if something was purged out of you that was released, that felt like a threshold point for you where you were like, ah, this is the medicine that's going to allow me to do the work I need to do to release this kind of cloud that you were describing.
I think the full insight was more of a process, a longer term process. And I think that because I had done so much self-reflection and knew myself fairly well of like, hey, this something's off here. And just through the trials that I'd gone through before, that when I went through that first experience, I instantly knew that it wasn't what my preconceptions led me to believe. I instantly, the instantaneous thing was, okay, there's something here. I don't know exactly what, I don't know if it's beneficial, but this is not what I thought it was. And coming from the military perspective, the fact that it was very hard and challenging. So my first two ceremonies, some visuals, but really just that full on physical war of just uncomfortability, you know, trying to regain some semblance of reality, just at all costs, not being able to do it. But that struggle also made me appreciate it. And so it was more of, again, I guess with that veteran mentality is like, I needed to respect it first before I could trust it and allow it to heal me. And then the healing sort of came, but it takes more reflection because you're still a little skeptical and you have to see what it is. But as it continued and as the effects, and I can go into those later, lasted and showed different areas where it did correct certain things, that's what made me a true believer. And then even more so seeing results repeated through my program, you know, even now, you know, like when you send people, you want the best for them. You want them to have the 100% miraculous case, and that's not always the case, but I'm still nervous. But more and more, it's like, yeah, this is a reliable way of at least helping them more than they've been helped before.
Mm. I'm curious, my big curiosity in talking to you is why you chose ayahuasca. You know, the listeners will probably be familiar with all the work that MAPS is doing with the phase, now they're moving on to the phase 3 trials with MDMA, working with PTSD and veterans. And MDMA and ayahuasca are very, very different experiences. And you mentioned just a moment ago about lasting effects. And so maybe we can tie that into this question here. But and of course, I'm guessing too, it's probably based on your own experience, but why the investment in ayahuasca versus MDMA, for example, or really any other psychedelic experience for this kind of healing?
Right. And, you know, science will sort of give us more insight. And at the end of the day, I think they're all tools and I think they all have a spot within a larger protocol of healing, depending on the type of trauma, the individual, and where they are at in their healing spot. So I don't think it's just one, like, ayahuasca is for PTSD, this is for depression. I think it's more of like, okay, well, this guy's really unstable. Maybe ketamine might be the first go-to to get them right back on level ground, or maybe MDMA. And then if they still need other, maybe a little bit more deeper, or maybe if they're missing that spiritual side or some other concept or have brain trauma, then maybe some of these plant-based psychedelics could be more beneficial. From where we're standing and given sort of the lack of infrastructure, I just tend to prefer ayahuasca for a variety of reasons over some of the others. So MDMA obviously is not available, and you don't want to give people, you know, stuff you buy off the street. But, and this is hypothesis based off of just my own experience and seeing possible mechanisms and what it works, is that ones like MDMA and possibly ketamine can work on more of the psychotherapy realm. And obviously ketamine has like the chemical effects as well, and so does MDMA. But in terms of sort of the lasting effects, what I've seen more often than not is that it's an enhanced talk therapy aspect, where it can enhance the normal talk therapy and get over mostly psychological based trauma, where there is that sort of war trauma, somebody had some very dire experiences, or they need that sort of trusting, they need that trust reform. Where what I've seen with more of the psilocybin and ayahuasca side of things is sort of the multi-layer side of dynamic of it, where it can have that psychotherapy side, but you're also in the first person seat of it, where you're discovering it, you're interpreting it on your own level, and you're fighting it on your own level as well, which can have its own power depending on the person. But then there is also that evidence of possibly more deeper physical healing, you know, some evidence of reduced inflammation, which we're trying to study right now, some evidence of increased neuroplasticity, neurogenesis. All these things could help, you know, possibly balance some certain hormone levels and possibly correct some of the damage by traumatic brain injury, which is prominent. And so for the people who are psychotherapists, you know, a lot of the studies are showing that for a lot of vets, a lot of the symptoms might be more related to traumatic brain injury from blast concussions, from airborne jumps, because they show very similar. They show, you know, you're seeing the same thing in athletes. And so if you're just addressing the psychotherapy side of things, but there is brain damage there, or there's inflammation in the brain, then you're only hitting one piece. And that's kind of the interesting thing of psychedelics, is that on some level, it seems to maybe be able to be operating on many different planes. Some other considerations with ayahuasca versus the others is that, you know, it just doesn't have that recreational side. There's still this religious, where, and veterans tend to self-medicate. And so I kind of want to get out of that. Whereas ayahuasca, you know, after you go through a ceremony, everyone's like, nope, I'm done. They might go back, but there's less of that sort of recreational, which is not bad. But for what we're trying to do and what we're trying to teach people about this is like, I'm going here for a purpose. I'm going here to heal. I respect this and this sort of apparatus. And even when they go back, they tend to respect mushrooms, or they tend to respect cannabis even more because they have that idea of where it plays. And like I said, it has, you know, mushrooms still has it, but it's much harder to find now, but it has this rich cultural tradition and this connection to the jungle, the Amazon. And, you know, the veterans just really get a lot out of that. So it's just a multi-consideration. It seems to, from my perspective, and I know there's going to be a lot of disagreement about this, but from what I've seen, it has that sort of Goldilocks era of, and especially, like I said, it's tough. It'll kick some people's asses, which they, for veterans, they like. And for whatever reason, I've just seen some pretty great results with PTSD.
Yeah, for me, I really love the MAO inhibitor piece of the ayahuasca brew, that there's that extra serotonin flood while you're in the experience, that to me, in my experiences with ayahuasca, I attribute that to part of the feeling of safety I feel even while I'm going through something very difficult. And I think that's kind of analogous to the safety in MDMA, which is also, you know, squeezing out those neurotransmitters for you. But yeah, that sense, there is a sense of safety in an ayahuasca experience, particularly a well-held ceremonial circle where there's, where the container is held really well, you can go to some really deep, dark places. And actually there feels like there's like a bit of grandmother energy holding your hand. There's safety. And, you know, you can always just puke up the darkness too. Like there's a very visceral experience of the purge that I think is very, very powerful when we're dealing with, you know, things from our past and shame, trauma, anger, like the physical experience of puking in the context of touching on these very painful things and then being able to actually throw it up. I've found that to be a pretty powerful aspect of the ayahuasca experience. I imagine it is for some of the people that you're taking through these experiences.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's just emphasizing that mind-body connection. It's just not one or the other. You're not just healing one side of it. You have to heal everything, you know? And a person hopefully goes back and eats healthier. They treat their body with respect. You know, we're actually doing a study with the University of Colorado in Boulder to test the effects of ayahuasca on the gut microbiome and then how that interplays with personality changes. So we have a dual study going with them and then the University of Georgia, who are doing more of the survey side of personality changes, you know, view changes. And so we're going to link the two together and see what changes in the gut microbiome and then how that changes is reflected in how the person acts.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I also like the medicine combo. If I'm dealing with depression, which depression is one of my dark passengers, if I have some depression coming in, combo is a pretty powerful clearing. And just, I think many of the listeners will know about combo. Combo is a topically applied poison from an Amazonian frog that creates a big purge. And I think that may also affect the gut biome and inflammation. And so, okay, so I am a veteran. I'm not really. For this example, I'm a veteran. I have tried different medications. I've been diagnosed with treatment-resistant depression and possibly PTSD. I'm not even sure about my diagnosis. It seems like a mess. I don't like dealing with the VA. I am so deeply ready for something else. Can you tell me the process that I go through to become part of Heroic Hearts, to go down to South America or Central America? Can you explain kind of the whole journey that I go on with this healing?
Yeah, of course. So a veteran will come to us, and generally it's by word of mouth. Like we've worked with some pretty prominent vets, and fortunately they share their stories, and that's how we get a lot of applicants afterwards. And then they can come, they can fill out an application. It's pretty extensive, and not only has like the baseline questions, but also, you know, tell us your story. Like, why are you here? What has led? What sorts of therapies have you tried? Where you're at right now? Have you tried psychedelics in the past? What are the effects? Just trying to get as much as possible in an application, you know, sort of the 360 view of the person. You know, we're a nonprofit. So when our basis of sending people is dependent on the money we get in. But when we are able to, or we find sponsorship and we're able to get a group together, sometimes a smaller group, sometimes 8 or 9 individuals, then we'll start reaching out, going through the applicants. First, we'll send out sort of an email of like, hey, we're planning this December 7th. It'll be a week long in Costa Rica. And then we try to have them pay for at least the flight or what they can. And so we'll put those qualifications. People respond back of like, hey, I'm really interested. I think I can do this. And from those that respond back, then that's when sort of the hard part of assessing the applications, because obviously there's no exact science. So the easy assessments are obviously, you know, if there is some sort of medical issue, if they have history of psychosis, if they have heart issues, assessing all that, figuring out what medications they're on. So we're sort of the first line. The retreats we work with double check it as well. And, you know, seeing where the medications, what medications are on, seeing what, you know, the counterindications, all that kind of stuff. Making sure it's safe, because obviously ayahuasca has the negative reaction. So if we find somebody, like, let's say that's not on medications, they're just really having a hard time. And of those, we want people who generally have tried some other therapies, who have done some self-work. And we want that because it indicates to me and to my team that they are willing to put in this work. You mentioned sort of the silver bullet. The last thing we want is somebody just going there of like, I don't want to put in work. I want this to cure me. Like, give me that magic. And they're most likely going to go back into old ruts. But somebody who's tried EMDR, who's gone to the VA, who's tried the whole string of things, that shows to me like they really do want to heal and that they are willing to put in the work. So if we find like a good group of that and I spend some time trying to see if the personalities align, like if it's a good group, there'll be good group cohesion. And then also similar to what I was saying before, how do they view trauma? A big indication that I've found is personality. So if they view their trauma as more of an obstacle to overcome versus them viewing that they are a victim of it and they are a victim of life constantly, the one that views as something to overcome generally, I think, makes a better candidate. The ones that view things more in victimhood, then those are the ones that might have more of a higher percentage chance of possibly having a hard experience and having that hard experience push them back a little bit more than progressing, which can be handled, but it takes much more work and sort of quality care. So obviously, you know, like I said, because it's minimal, you know, we have to work with the fund. So obviously I want the candidates that are going to take this and run with it. So when we assess that, then generally 2 months out, that's when the preparation pre-integration phase starts. We notify them, we generally have a backup, get all the paperwork, get all the logistics, flights, all that out of the way. And we have integration coaches that are certified by a company called Being True to You. We try to do as much as possible one-on-one. The coaches will link up with them, try to do a few sessions beforehand, getting them in that mind frame of answering the questions, calming nerves, but then also talking about what intentions are, intentions versus expectations, not projecting any one experience, but getting them prepared so that they're just not steamrolled by the whole experience. We'll do some group Zoom chat calls just to get everybody online, answer any follow-up questions. And then the retreat centers that we work with in a variety of countries, we've vetted them as well. So myself or somebody on our team has gone there. Do our ethos align? Are they more focused on therapy versus just getting a few more bucks? Are they willing to, you know, are they comfortable with larger groups of veterans? Because not everyone is. So then the retreats, you know, we've worked with them. They generally have their own program that obviously we're happy with. So they go to work there. They work, you know, with shaman that know what they're doing and have been doing it for quite a while. And, you know, most of the ones we have, they're sustainable. They have respect for the tradition. They bring all the preserving the nature of what the ayahuasca ceremony is, which I think is important. And then the tail end, the post-integration, the integration work. They link back up, they come back, talk to them, how did it go, link back up with their coaches, and then we try to do group chats for as long as the group's interested. You know, sometimes they sort of like fall off and then you'll go from 8 to 2 and then maybe nobody. And so, but if we're always there, if they want to reignite it, and then the coach will follow up with them. And then we just sort of try to keep in touch with them as much as possible. You know, it's not after that, after, you know, 3 or 4 months, we've had some group Zoom chats go for over a year. So it's really dependent on them and how they're doing with it. And then, you know, in the background, we have just a lot of professionals that help us out that, in the worst case, which fortunately we really haven't had any, if somebody has a really hard time coming back in that integration phase, then we have professional, you know, therapists that are on call that will like talk to them and link up with them.
That is such a beautifully comprehensive offering. You know, and I love that you have such a full view of what these folks need, you know, because the last thing that someone who has suffered as much as some of these folks have would want is to go to the Amazon, have this incredible experience, and then just be sort of put out in the world, put back into the same environment with no support. And so it's so wonderful to hear that you've got such a comprehensive view of integration with this program. You mentioned earlier in the podcast these lasting effects, and I'm curious, as you've stayed in touch with the veterans who've gone through Heroic Hearts, what are some of the lasting effects? What are some of the testimonials that people have expressed, you know, months out or further out from having done this?
Yeah, I mean, the beautiful thing about it is I'll still just get that random text of like, hey, thank you again. You know, this is going great. And you know, I think they all come to that point after the honeymoon phase where they realize, and we try to train this, but there's nothing you can do, that life can still be kind of shitty and that it's going to slap you in the face still, and it's going to throw you through loops. But it's a question of now you have the tools, hopefully, better able to tackle when those obstacles do arise. Or, you know, for a lot of people that have that ability to almost zoom out and see themselves in more of this third person, to where something would derail them completely, now they can kind of take that step back and be like, oh, I know this is stressing me out, I know I'm anxious, let's stop this before it gets spirals downwards. And so, and it is a spectrum, you know, there is no 100%. And so on the one side, I've seen complete like transformations of people like just really taking it, and it's a beautiful thing. And on the other side, maybe it's a little bit more subtle, you know. Fortunately, we haven't had any people of the ones that we've sent that say that they're worse off because of it. We did sort of an internal poll, and everybody answered that their lives have improved since that ceremony. And so that's an amazing thing. And that's how it is. You're never going to get the same result. You're never going to get 100%. But if this is giving them even that small step to overcome something that they haven't been able to get a step on in the past 10 years, then even for them, that's hope, which is more powerful than, you know, many other things. It gives them that ability to survive and continue on, especially in the veteran community. It's suffering from a massive suicide epidemic. So having something that brings hope and shows them a glimmer into something more powerful than them that they probably didn't experience before, it's just a very powerful combination.
And this offering through Heroic Hearts is so comprehensive. I imagine that it's a lot to fund, you know, when you're talking about these integration coaches, all of the time of the team that you described, quite a sophisticated team. So where are you raising money for this program? Do you think that maybe at some point the VA might be wanting to contribute something, or is it mainly private donors or institutional donors? Like where does the money come to allow you to do this?
Yeah, I mean, the VA is the slow moving giant. It's not going to get ayahuasca on its menu for at least 20 more years, if that. Hopefully the MDMA, they adopt that quickly, because that's just another tool, and psilocybin should follow pretty quickly. And, you know, fortunately, Heroic Hearts is an all volunteer staff, myself included. So it does take a lot of time and love, but everybody has been so generous in providing that. And so we've been able, because of that, to keep costs down. So It's still expensive, but we average about, every vet costs about $4,000, all things considered, which really isn't that bad when you compare it to the effect and you compare it to the equivalent in number of therapy sessions that they might need. So yeah, I mean, it's tough. I'm sure everybody can sympathize. In this world, there's not necessarily grants. It's hard to get corporate funding. Dr. Bronner's has been amazing. They've supported us from the get-go, and really thought leaders on this and all sorts of other things. Just a lot of generous individuals who see these veteran stories, who know veterans in their life, and have really pushed this forward with unsolicited donations. We've had a lot of very generous people actually sponsor vets or sponsor whole retreats even. And then on our side, you know, on my side, I guess as the founder, it's just always being creative in ways of finding new funding. And so, you know, we'll get groups together that we've had like athletes with veterans, and the athletes fortunately were able to cover the costs of the retreat, but then they get this, they bond really well with the veterans. And so, you know, people who had these abilities to might be more financially able, but still are looking for healing, and then combining those two. So we've explored options like that have been very powerful. You know, it's all determination, and it's tough, but it's possible, you know, and that's what we're showing. And as psychedelics get more traction, then it'll hopefully be more possible.
So I'd like to have a brief conversation on a somewhat sensitive topic around veterans and psychedelic healing. So forgive me if I fumble at all with this. Ayahuasca is very much a nature, earth, healing, planet experience. And it comes from South America. And Latin America as a whole has really suffered from U.S. foreign policy. And so all veterans deserve healing. And all people who've been harmed in these combat zones deserve healing. The U.S. government is deploying troops around the world. And if these troops can go into these war zones and be involved in situations that are enormously traumatizing, and then they can come back and be healed with psychedelic medicine, one concern would be, does the healing of psychedelic medicine potentially empower more war if, as part of the calculation of a government that is deploying troops? So my question is, that's kind of setting the table of what's a little mm-hmm. delicate about it. But in terms of veterans who are using this medicine, are they having experiences around their own service and questions around military service generally? And do you, as the leader of this organization, how do you feel about some of the ways that the U.S. military has acted in the world in the context of Latin American countries and then where this healing is coming from?
Right. So, I mean, obviously, I'm against the war on drugs. You know, if you go back to the reasons that it was started and the reason that it continued and just the efficacy and all the trauma that's been caused since, it's obvious, you know, it's unfortunately there are political players that have more self-interest versus a global interest or even a basic human interest. You know, it's a complicated question, and I'm not of the opinion that healing people, even soldiers, leads to more war. And I think at the very basis, it is that question. Like, even if you don't agree with the policies or what this person does, you know, from a medical standpoint, everybody deserves to be treated. Everybody deserves to be healed. And so, you know, they are my community, and I will do everything I can to heal them. The fact that there's more soldiers does not cause more wars. It's policy. It's the higher level. And I talked about this on Lauren's podcast as well, is, you know, it's, I personally believe in sort of the archetype of the warrior. I think there, if you go back in history, there's always been that warrior. There's always been that protector. And it does seem to be a spirit that is transcultural. And even in the Amazon region, even in Latin America, there is the respect. And I've traveled to many different countries, and I can bond with a lot of people there, even if I can't speak the same language, because they find out that I am a soldier, a warrior, and that is a universal commitment. And unfortunately, we haven't figured out a way to not have a war. And so I don't think just by healing these people or not healing these people, you're going to address that issue. I think it's a much different level. And so what I think personally is that on the soldier side, and what drew me to it, is that ideal. I do believe I have a warrior spirit. I do believe I see people with warrior spirits, whether or not they're soldiers or not. It comes in many forms. But that's what drove me to that, for more idealistic principles of, for me, there is sometimes a need for a country to have a protecting force, or a community to have a protecting force, or even individuals to have that protector. And if I want to protect or represent and do that self-sacrifice for things that have been so beneficial for me, then that's why I wanted to join, to self-sacrifice for something bigger than me. And that was my sort of ideal. And I think that's important, even if it's not military, to sacrifice to something bigger than yourself. And that being said, it's not me who chose the war. You can argue that I chose to go into the war at that time. But I don't know. I think there's a lot of soldiers that have been in military for a while, and they trust politicians. They trust a higher level political body to make the right decisions and use them in an effective way. And again, you can argue with like just war, but there is obviously a spectrum there. And so if the leaders are abusing this class in that way, then that is a dysfunctional society. That is not just one person or the other. And obviously, everything has nuance. You know, not everybody's going in there for the same sort of reasons, but there is a universal wanting to protect others from the people that I've associated with. And so I think that's a tragedy. And that's what you're seeing after like Vietnam. And I think you're going to see a pretty massive one after these two endless wars, is that they caused a scar on society, Vietnam especially, is because there was this distrust between these veterans and between the government and a misuse of these forces. And you're seeing the same thing with the war on drugs. And as extended, there's a lot of veterans that don't understand why we are still there. Even if they agreed with the initial purposes, then like, why are we there 20 years afterwards? That, like I said, causes a scar, and it's just an unhealthy society. And so, you know, there you have to be sensitive. So if there are people that are offended, especially in Latin America, you have to be sensitive and you have to listen to them. And hopefully you can come to a bond. And I think psychedelics cross-culturally, it's not going to heal all wounds, but it can heal some big ones. And I think under this healing presence is, or pretense, is some way that we can unite in more of a way, you know, not having politics, not having any of this other geopolitical. Most people can agree that people should have the ability and the right to heal, and especially with something that's effectively. And I think there can be bonding without appropriation or without larger geopolitical issues there.
I really appreciate the elegance of that answer. Yeah, I was curious about whether I would bring up that question, you know, but I feel like when we're having this conversation, it's important. And I think the answer is not to treat soldiers with ayahuasca. I think the answer is to treat soldiers with ayahuasca and treat the politicians with ayahuasca. You know, like if we could give our leaders the experience of that oceanic oneness that you can achieve in the state of a deep psychedelic ceremony, I think we would see a lot of different choices about where those soldiers are deployed and what their lives look like. And so, you know, my feeling about psychedelics and part of why I'm so passionate is that I believe that these technologies allow us to understand something bigger than ourselves. And that's how we get out of these, you know, OCD or depression or PTSD, these fixed places we get in our brains. We can transcend that by seeing the world and our own spirit as bigger than our individual experience. And I feel like the more we can have people have these experiences and then be in leadership roles, we're going to see transformation because of that. So,
yeah, I mean, I agree. I think the issue is finding ways to promote more conscious leadership and preventing self-serving interests. And I think that's a universal, that's on a poli-sci level, that's always been the hardest part. Like, how do you get legitimate people that actually want to help humanity, help their society, without the people that are self-serving, that are making money, that, you know, are doing it for more nefarious reasons? How do you balance that?
So switching gears completely, can you reflect on a moment that you felt most proud, or one of the moments where you felt most proud of the work that you're doing with Heroic Hearts? Someone that you took through the program, a particular moment of working with someone, a particular message. Can you think of something where when you reflect on this memory, you're like, yes, this is exactly why I'm dedicating my life to this work?
I mean, there's been multiple moments, obviously. Just coming back to my family and when they hear some of these veteran testimonials and just seeing, even if they didn't understand from the get-go, of the power of what they're doing and them being humbled by it. You know, somebody I worked with when I was a ranger, he went through the program and had a pretty profound, and he was like much higher up than me. So that was kind of, that was more of a cool moment than anything else. And it keeps reoccurring, you know, the nature of the nonprofit gets you down of any running any business, but then seeing the results and seeing these transformations are what, like, you have to have those moments of confidence. You have to have those moments where it's like, all right, let's keep going. Like, this is why I'm doing it. You know, one that sticks out is a guy who's a special forces, a Green Beret. And he's one of those that's on the one side where he just had a complete transformation to where he returned to like the goofy self that he was before the military. Still, obviously, he's like in the military still and still being able to function. But he just told me a story of him going back to his 10-year-old son and being able to enjoy that experience much more, because before he's like that by the book, like straightforward, like no playtime, I got to get you to school. And now he's like goofing off, making pancakes with his kid. And for me, I always tell that story because it demonstrates the power of healing is not just on the individual, but it's on a family unit, and it's also multi-generational, you know, like his kid had that distrust of him when he first came back, because he was like, who is this person? I've never known this person. But, you know, it's probably been a learning process, and I'm sure with his wife as well. But, you know, hopefully that relationship now that they're fostering carries on with the kid, as opposed to maybe the kid has a bad, not saying Rudy was abusive before, but you do have those cases where because of that bad parent-child relationship, it carries on to their children and possibly even the next children. And so, I mean, that's the power of, and again, this kind of ties back to your other question, is if you are healing this generation of veterans, imagine what that does to their kids and future generations as well.
I so resonate with that. The ancestral healing quality of shamanic medicines and plant medicines is just, it's such a beautiful and profound process of healing yourself and healing, you know, your understanding of those who might have harmed you in terms of your ancestors and your ability to be a father, to be a mother. I'm not going to fanboy about ayahuasca too much, though. But I do. It is my favorite of all the medicines. We, at the beginning of the podcast, I asked you about what psychedelic therapists might need to know in terms of working with veterans. And I'd like to return to that question, because at the end of every podcast, I ask my guests to speak directly to the psychedelic healers out there, the shamans, the ketamine doctors, the retreat leaders. For the folks who are dedicating their lives, their professional work to healing, what would you like to say to those people?
Well, I mean, one, thank you. I mean, especially a lot of these underground healers have been keeping the flame alive, you know, in the U.S. and have really informed a lot of the research and just everything that's going on right now. And that's, you know, a lot of the, like you said, have risked their own professional careers, their own livelihood. And that takes a lot of courage. Again, that's that warrior spirit that I'm talking about. That's not necessarily just in the soldier. You know, I think if you're going to work with veterans is, if you're hesitant about it, then maybe reach out to another veteran, reach out to me, and, you know, I can help out, or somebody else can help out, or some other veteran that, if you have somebody you've served that is a veteran, that can really help you with the link. But the biggest thing is, as with any other patient, you know, don't prejudge, understand where the person's coming from. Just because they might've been through all these wars, and even if you have different political perspectives, a lot of people will surprise you. And so it's just understanding where they're coming from and trying to find that, you know, you're going to have completely different lives and different experiences, but there tends to always be that commonality. And so I think a lot of this is just trying to figure out, you know, what is the commonality between us?
Yeah, we need that so much. We need to find commonality. So much of healing is about understanding that there are all these different pieces to our society, all these different perspectives. And within our own system, there's these different pieces, and that it's all kind of coming into balance, I think, is a huge part of healing, and not being stuck in binaries of, you know, this part of me is bad and I don't want to look at it. This part of me is good, or these people are bad, these people are good. I you know, really coming back to the idea that everyone deserves this kind of healing. And I think with the work that you're doing and the work a lot of others are doing in this field, trying to make awareness that these are really powerful healing modalities. And, you know, ayahuasca, for example, has been carried by these lineage holders for centuries. And it's such an incredible gift to the human race to be able to sit in ceremony and to experience these really transforming visions. Well, Jesse, how can we support you? How can we, I know that you're definitely down for donations, because it takes a lot to support what's going on. But for the listeners out there who've been inspired by your story and the work you're doing, what are some ways that we can support your mission?
Yeah, of course. And I leave it up to whoever's listening who wants to support, to work with us, to find a way, even if it's not financial. The easiest, obviously, is the financial. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. I mentioned before, any donation, 100% goes straight to helping vets. None of us take any money. And so the website, heroicheartsproject.org, has donations. We have Patreon. You know, just the simple follow us on social media helps us spread the message. You know, if we see posts, continue to spread the word. you never know who in your community, I guarantee, maybe not you, but somebody one or two people away knows a veteran and knows, you know, maybe a veteran that's struggling. So it's within your community at some level. We've also recently started an ambassador program. And the goal of the ambassador program is to better empower people who want to help but don't necessarily know how to help. And it's not just the veteran cause, but in my mind, the psychedelic journey in general, because what we are doing with these veteran voices is we are appealing to parts of the country in the US, the UK, and Canada that would normally never even have a discussion about psychedelics. But because the message is being brought by a veteran, somebody that they normally trust and respect, it adds power to it and it appeals to a much broader audience. And I believe by hitting not just the stereotypical hotspots of this, but by a much broader demographic, that's how you're going to truly get traction and truly allow people. And so if people are interested, the ambassadors have, you know, civilians, people who might not think they have skill sets, professionals. So we have marketers, we have therapists, and veterans too, who, you know, have been helped by psychedelics and want to continue to help others. So if you just go to our website, it's ways to support. There's an ambassador application. It's pretty quick. And then we'll bring you into some calls and brainstorm of ways to go forward. You know, I'm not a know-it-all. This is all uncharted territory. So it really takes the community to figure out, okay, what's the best way to move this forward? You know, we've had people sponsor individual veterans. There's all sorts of options. The sky's the limit. If you want to support, we'll figure out a way that works best for everybody.
I love this ambassador program. I think it's really smart and helps to build community too, you know, helps to build these connections and help people who maybe are feeling isolated to come in and be part of something. And are there people who've gone through the program with you who then have now become ambassadors? Is that because that seems like that would be a cool way to do it too, is like you go through the experience. You know, integration is a long process. So to stay close to the organization and kind of support it and be connected, that might be a really powerful community building for some folks who maybe felt deeply bonded to their fellow service people out in the field and then come back and they're not as connected with people, to be in supporting an organization like this that does support veterans, that includes a lot of veterans, that could be a beautiful place for community as well. So I think that the ambassador program is a great thing for that.
Yeah, we've had it on both sides, especially like veterans that come back and really want to spread the word. We're actually this coming year going to train some of these veterans that we sent to be integration coaches themselves. So just a complete pay it forward. And you really touched on it, is it's all about community. It's having these profound changes and then not having anybody to go back to, again, is going to have limited benefit. But if you go back to this community that supported you, that maybe even financed your journey there, that is where, you know, has therapists that can help you out if you need to go back, that's the beauty of it. And that's what's going to make this sustainable. And so the ambassador program is trying to find out how can we make this sustainable on a local level so that we're not just trying to, you know, dole it out on a impersonal higher level, but have actually people meet in person when that's possible again and sustain it, pay it forward. Veterans are severely lacking that. And I think the community in general is lacking that.
Yeah. I love that community piece. I think that's, you know, and that could be self-perpetuating for the whole program, you know, getting these veterans in as integration therapists, because, you know, it's like the old Alcoholics Anonymous thing. Like when you're helping someone else, it keeps you on your track, you know, like it gives purpose and meaning. And I love that. I think it's brilliant. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been great talking to you and getting to know you and learning about Heroic Hearts. Anything that you were really excited to share today that we might have missed in our conversation? Because there's a lot to talk about here. I just want to make sure we didn't miss anything salient.
No, I mean, I think we covered it. You know, just one of the other things in the new year, where we still focus on ayahuasca, but we're also trying to explore other options. You know, whether it's psilocybin or ketamine, and so we're doing our due diligence right now and talking with a lot of clinics. And like I said, I believe they're all tools and they can all be helpful for people at different stages of their healing. And so, you know, I'm personally just excited. COVID slowed it down a little bit, but it seems to be roaring back. And so hopefully once there's more semblance of normal, you know, we'll see some pretty amazing things as this progresses.
Well, and we will keep our eyes on the work that you're doing. I think you and Lauren Taus, who is on this program, who you've been on her program, she mentioned that you might be exploring ketamine with her and I think Phil Wolfson as well, to, you know, that sort of community. And, you know, that's a little cheaper than going to the Amazon, but at the same time, it's not ayahuasca. I mean, at least for in my experience, I think ketamine is a powerful healing modality, but, you know, ayahuasca for me is the one that really takes you all the way. But I think it's cool that you're doing all this, exploring these new avenues, and I'm looking forward to tracking the work that you're doing and potentially having you back on the show to talk about it. If you start opening up some new programs, we can do a little show, do a little announcement. So we'll definitely be in a continuing conversation with the incredible work you're doing.
For sure. I appreciate it. Again, thank you for the platform. Thank you for helping us spread the message. And yeah, I look forward to the next conversation. I'm glad our technology held out.
Right? Yeah. We managed all the way through. Well, thank you so much, Jesse.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.